So if you got your Bibles with you, let's turn to the book of Esther, And we're going to start off this way. There have been writers and theologians that write about something that's known as a shadow mission. Let me tell you what a shadow mission is. Like if I go outside in the sunshine right now, depending on the angle of the sun, my shadow will be cast upon the ground. Now my shadow resembles me, but it is not me. And likewise, you know, we all have a mission. To bring glory to God through the unique talents and gifts that He has given every one of us. That's what His children's mission are. But so many of us can get lost and have gotten lost, including myself, in what's known as a shadow mission. A shadow mission, whether it's 180 degrees off course or whether it's 10 degrees off course, is not your mission. And you can waste an entire life. And then here's the thing about the shadow mission. It does not bring any joy, doesn't bring any peace. Doesn't satisfy the longing of your soul. Give you an example. Here's a shadow mission that I used to have. my shadow mission used to be doing things because people needed me. And I felt quite wrongly that being needed proved my worth. And the problem with that is if I do things for that reason, it becomes about me. I imagine, you know, how appreciative people will be. And then I get resentful when I don't feel properly appreciated. I feel exhausted at the end of the day. But my true mission, really, which is twofold, it's encouraging people with the grace of God. That's one of my missions. And one of the gifts and callings is I like to seek fairness. I used to hate it when I was a kid and people would say, well, life's not fair. Well, it should be. And that's right? It should be. And I get so irritated about it because I think that's a really easy way not to fight for justice. So that's influenced my secular profession. It's but pointing people to God's grace, that's the other calling on my life. And when I do things for that motivation, it feels very different. And so in the process of helping other people, it's not about me, it's about pointing them to God, and that feels really good. Just, you know, a couple of examples. Whether back in the day when we would do home services at the nursing home, you know, you come to a long day after preaching, and then you go out and you'd serve others. And I actually walked away from those instances feeling refreshed and revitalized. Or at the end of a long work day, going and counseling with somebody, physically might be tired, but inside I felt energized, and it was nice. I still feel that way when I help other people, as long as I'm following my mission, and it's about God, and not my shadow mission, and it's about me. So I want to kind of, before we jump into the book of Esther, ask you, what's your shadow mission? Because we all got it. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And that means everybody here. And there's a way that you can probably tell the difference between your shadow mission and your true mission. You know, a shadow mission will exhaust you while your true mission energizes you. A shadow mission will come from guilt or insecurity, whereas your true mission comes from freedom and love. Stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ has set you free. A shadow mission is about you while your true mission is about God. It can involve you, but ultimately it's about God. A shadow mission leads to resentment, but a true mission lets you serve no matter what the response is. And if you walk along the shadow mission long enough, you're going to feel even more distant from God, whereas a true mission makes you and brings you closer to Him. And most of all, there's just no joy in the shadow mission, while a true mission will lead you to joy, even if it's hard. So we're going to go to the book of Esther. It's one of the favorite books in the Old Testament, although there are some theologians that have said it doesn't belong in the Bible. John Calvin never preached a single sermon from it. Martin Luther said he wished it wasn't in the Bible, and the reason for that is the name of God is never expressly mentioned. So you got a lot of historical writings about this. But one of the common threads of the book of Esther is you see God at work, even if He's not expressly mentioned. So I enjoy the book of Esther, but what points out to me is when we see the book of Esther, we're going to come across, it's a story of characters who are all given choices a number of choices between mission and shadow mission, and depending on which one they serve and which one they do, destinies get formed, worlds get changed. So if you would, turn with me to the book of Esther, and if you can't remember where it is, it's been a little while. It's right after the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Maybe it's easier, it's right before the book of Job and Psalm. So going with me to the book of Esther, it's a story that's set in the capital of Persia, in the capital city of Susa, and it concerns the Israelites who are living in exile around the year 470 B.C., so about 2,500 years ago. And we're going to walk through the book together. I'm going to start reading just the first nine chapters, but keep your Bible open because we're going to walk through the book together. And then we're going to come back to some of the chapters in subsequent weeks. Verse 1, the word of the Lord reads, "Now it came to pass in the day of Ahasuerus." Now, so you know, Ahasuerus is the Arab name for what the Greeks called Xerxes. So this is a story, a true story, about King Xerxes. And it says, "It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus." This is Ahasuerus which reigned even from India unto Ethiopia, over 170 and 20 provinces, that in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, and the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. Verse 4, "And when he showed the riches of the glorious kingdom, in the honor of his excellent majesty, many days, even 104 days." So for 6 months, these people. "And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people which were present in Shushan the palace, both under the great and under the small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace." So party number two. "Where were white, green, blue hangings fastened with cord of fine linen, purple the silver rings, and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse, one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, for this king had so appointed to all officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also, Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus." So here's what the author wants us to understand about Ahasuerus. This was a man of immense power, and he had a kingdom that extended from Asia Minor down to Africa all the way over to India and parts of India. But he's not an admirable character, and the writer gives us a picture of a king who wants to show off his greatness. He's very ostentatious, somewhat narcissistic. But in fact, he has no inner strength of spirit at all and constantly needs other people to make up his mind about stuff. And so the first time we see him, it is like this great banquet. And there are three banquets in the first nine verses alone. And it's actually one of the ways you can kind of divide up the book by the banquets. And so the first one lasts literally 6 months, 6 months of serious partying. And when that's over, you go to verse 5, and he has another party. And this party is for the whole capital, and it's open to the common people. And Xerxes wants to show how much immense power he has. So the goblets are goblets of gold that he's letting the common people drink out of. So, and then verse 9 says that the drinking was done according to every man's pleasure. So literally, the second party was drinking without restraint. The kingdom of Persia had become Animal House. And then in the ninth verse, we see the third banquet, which was thrown by Queen Vashti. And here there are no excesses, no juvenile behavior. By contrast, she looks kind of constrained. But in the seventh verse, it said, "The heart of the king was merry with wine, so he sins for Queen Vashti." Many of y'all know the story already. He sins to Queen Vashti because he wants to show off his trophy wife, along with all the other possessions that he has, and his trophy wife is his ultimate possession. Now, what do you think that he wants to show the people about her? Her brains? "Hey, Vashti, come and figure out the antiderivative of x cubed. It's 3x squared, by the way. I want to show off your math brain. Xerxes, calculus hasn't been invented yet? Okay, well, why don't we talk about the rise and ultimate fall of the Babylonian Empire, kind of show off her brain. Xerxes wasn't interested in any of that. What he wants to do is show off her beauty. He wants to show off her beauty at this time, and it says in verse 11, because she was fair to look upon. He married a trophy wife, and he was going to show her off. Now, we don't know the details, but apparently it was going to be done in a very humiliating way, and that brings us to verse 12, because something extraordinary happens. Vashti says, I don't think so. No, I'm going to go wash my hair. You're going to bring me and parade me before a crazy mob after 7 days of Miller time? Uh-uh. So it says, no. She says, no. And it says in verse 12, and what happens with the king? Does he, like, rethink his position? You know, on second thought, maybe that wasn't such a... No, it says in verse 12, it says, therefore the king was very wroth. Children, that means anger. And his anger burned within him. Because this struck at his sense of power. It struck at his sense of dominance. It always does with narcissists, the image that he wanted to project. Because King Ahasuerus was living his shadow mission. It wasn't about God. It was about him and his image and his needs. He liked all the likes that he got on Facebook and Instagram. And he didn't like being stood up to. And so what happens is verse 13 is he consults the wise men. Another word for that is the sages. Think of it as the Supreme Court of counselors, some seasoned veterans. And it says in verse 13, then the king said unto the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner towards all that knew law and judgment. And here, right here, so you know, the writer is actually poking fun at King Ahasuerus. Poking fun at King Ahasuerus, Xerxes, because the most powerful man in the world needs advice on how to control his woman. He can control everything, but he can't control his bride. And so he asks them, and they, what am I going to do with my wife? I mean, she refused to come, and he's just trying to find a way to get back at her. And so they advise him to issue a royal order, verse 19 and 20. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written in the law of the Medes and the Persians that is not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus. That's going to break her heart, isn't it? She didn't want to go before him in the first place. Men. And let the king give a royal estate unto another that is better than she. And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great. And so what the writer there is doing is kind of showing that the people that the king surrounds himself just keep flattering him, just keep pumping him up. None are willing to tell him the hard truth. Dude, you need to apologize. But they say, do this, for all the wives shall give their husbands honor, both to great and small. And the king thinks, well, that's a good idea. That's what I'm going to do. And so he deposes Vashti, and that brings us to chapter 2. It says, after these things, the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, and he remembered Vashti, and what she had done, and what was decreed against her. And then said the king to the servants that ministered to him. Okay, so, you know, in chapter 1, he talked to the wise men, but now he's talking to the servants, the young people that guarded him. Now, just a question. Young, testosterone-filled men. What kind of advice do you think that they gave the king about finding a new woman? Hey, king. Here's what you need to do it good. You need to go out there and look for a woman of character. That's a good idea. King, what you need to do is you need to go out there and look up a woman that is a good servant and leads from a servant heart. No, their number one priority was beauty. And so they suggest that he holds a Miss Medes and Persian contest and that everybody would contribute to the royal harem from the best-looking women in the province. And remember, we were told in chapter 1 that there were 127 provinces, and that's a big harem. And in the end, they say the girl who pleases the king, who turns his head, who makes him go, wow, that's the girl that will ultimately become his trophy wife. Now, I know it's hard to believe in our day that there was a culture so superficial that middle-aged men would try and impress other people that they had so much wealth and power that they could attract a wife of youth and beauty. But once there was a time when there was a culture that superficial. I know it's hard to believe that the human race could sink to such trivial depths. But there was a day when that kind of thing happened. I know it's hard for us to wrap our arms around the fact that there was a kind of world that prized beauty higher than anything else. But that's what this dark world was like 2,500 years ago. And that's what the king does. In one of the contests, there's a young Jewish girl named Esther. She's an orphan girl. She's lost her father and mother. And she's been raised by Mordecai, who is either her uncle or her cousin. Really not 100% sure about that. And we're told that she, and this is what the young men say, chapter 2. And after these things, the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, and he remembered Vashti and what she had done. He had sobered up. And what was decreed against her, then said the king's servants that ministered to him, that let there be a fair young virgins sought for the king. And so they published the proclamation, and all the women come up, and we're told that there's Esther, and she's beautiful. And that's the ancient language. She can turn heads. She made it through the prelims. And she's one of the finalists. And as one of the finalists, she goes to prepare for him. So let's talk a second about the preparation. Now, I got to set this up for a moment because it's kind of a big deal, this preparation thing to go before the king. This is not just a casual deal. So for all the women who are here in this room or listening to us online, I want you to think back to a time that you were getting ready for a date, that you were really interested in having this date go well. And so think about the amount of time that you spent preparing for this date, both bathing and hair and makeup and wardrobe selection and accessories and fragrance. And it's just honesty time right now, okay? So how many of you have ever spent more than an hour getting ready for a date? Whether it was applying your Mally makeup or maybe your Sellout by Urban Decay. How many of you spent more than an hour, right? Well, how many of you actually spent more time getting ready for the date than you actually spent on the date? How many of you actually had more fun getting ready for the date than you actually had on the date itself? So, all right. Now, what I want you to do is look at the amount of prep time in Esther's first date with the king. So before the girl's turn came to go before King Ahasuerus, she had to complete verse 12. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go into the king Ahasuerus, after that, she had been 12 months, according to the manner of women, for so were the days of their purification accomplished, to wit, 6 months of oil of myrrh, 6 months of sweet odors, and other things for the purifying of the women. That's a lot of pressure on a first date. And I don't know if the women just smelled bad back then, but they had to literally bathe for 6 months in oil and six more months of perfume. It's a lot of pressure. And I mean, if somebody's not attracted to you after you spent 12 months getting ready, it probably just wasn't going to happen. That's what the girls had to go through so that they could turn the king's head. And Esther does this, and Esther wins. And so verse 17 says that the king is more attracted to Esther than any of these other women. She was the best-looking woman of 127 provinces. She outshines them all. She won favor of all who saw her, and she is the most beautiful woman in the kingdom. And so the king, in chapter 2, verse 18, in typical fashion, throws another party. And Esther is his wife. And her mission is to be arm candy for the most powerful man in the world. And Esther lives happily ever after. And thus ends the story. Well, no. See, this isn't Disney. This is the Bible. And it's real life. So let's go to chapter 3, verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. And after those things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. For the king so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Now, remember, Mordecai was Esther's guardian. He sat at the king's gate, which meant he was one of the royal officials. And as a just a note that we'll learn later, he actually saved the king one time from an assassination. And this man would not bow down to Haman. And Haman was obsessed with this. You know why? Because Haman was living a shadow mission. Haman's shadow mission was, life is all about Haman. And I want respect. Straight out of the Godfather. It's all about respect. That's Haman's shadow mission. God's not mentioned in the life of Haman, except maybe implied in judgment. Haman is so obsessed with honor that this man won't bow down to him before him. It's just intolerable to him, and it grates on him. And when Haman saw Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. And that's what anger will do to you. It'll take an isolated incident, and if you let it fester, you will blow out of your response will be out of proportion to the offense. You see what happened to Haman? He got so mad that he says, you know, not only do I want to destroy Haman, I want to destroy all his people. I want to destroy the whole Jewish nation. Anger does that. That's why the Apostle Paul says, you know, don't let the root of bitterness take root in your soul. Because if you start going down that path, it does not end well. Chapter 3, verse 10 and 11. What happens is Haman goes to Xerxes and he offers him a bribe, which is really the equivalent of 300 tons of silver, like the gross domestic product of most nations on the earth. That's what Haman does to appease his anger. You know, when you're angry, you don't make good decisions. I would really encourage everybody here, never make a decision when you're angry. Let me go. Never write an email when you're angry. Never send a text when you're angry. Do not respond in anger. And so what happens is, we go to chapter 4, verse 1. And so Haman in chapter 3, he goes to the king, he says, look, I'll give you all this money. And the king's like, okay, you know, whatever. I don't even know what group of people you're talking about, Haman. Then we go to Esther chapter 4, verse 1, and Mordecai hears about this. And it says, chapter 4, verse 1, when Mordecai perceived all that was doing, Mordecai rent his clothes, put on sackcloth with ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter voice. And we kind of look at this as an expression of grief. But actually, too, it was a political act of protest. It was like standing outside the White House with a picket sign. And it's an extraordinary act of courage. And Mordecai is a remarkable man. You know why? Because he's living his true mission. And he knows that his people are the people of God. It's not about Mordecai, it's about his people. Remarkable man. But it becomes quite clear to him that if anything productive is going to be done, if the people are going to be saved, it has to be up to Esther. And so he goes to this young girl whom he raised, this beauty queen, the eye candy, the trophy wife of Ahasuerus, and he says, you're going to have to go to the king and you're going to have to turn this deal around. And for very good reasons, Esther doesn't want to. We see in chapter 4, verse 11, it says, Esther sends word to Mordecai. All the king's servants and all the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall lay out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these days. Okay, so here's what we know. The king is pretty careful about protocol. And the king doesn't like it when people just come into him in any time they want to. It's kind of seen as a defiance to the king. And so what Esther says is she knows what happened to Vashti. The king has one law. You don't get to come unto me unless I sent for you or I'll kill you. I have the right to kill you unless I extend the royal scepter. And then she says one more thing to Mordecai that you can know. Look, 30 days have passed since I was called to go into the king. So I want you to think about this for just a second. They are a husband and wife, and they had been apart for 30 days. Now, I'm not a marriage counselor, but going to the Scooby-Doo marriage counseling seminar, rut-row, it's been 30 days. Okay, something's not right here. Maybe the initial joy and initial excitement of their youthful marriage is kind of past because the dude has a full harem. This is not a devoted husband, and it's very clear to Esther that the king is not as excited about her as he was in the early days of the marriage. So she has a really good reason to question how much influence she has at all. Now, at this point, most folks would stop at this point and say to Esther, you know what, Esther, I understand. Never mind. Don't do it. You know, we'll figure out another way. But not Mordecai. Because Mordecai is living his true mission. Mordecai knows that God is big. God is everywhere. None can stay his hand. Chapter 4, verse 12. And they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not of thyself that thou shalt find escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So y'all know there's another theme and kind of a little subtext in the book of Esther. And Mordecai is expressing faith in someone who does not get named in this book, but is at work all the time. He is at work in every situation. You know, deliverance will come from another person, but don't think you're going to escape judgment. Who knows but that you were raised for such a time as this? You know, thy and thy father's house shall be destroyed. Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Esther, the fate of your people, the fate of the nation is in your hands. And if you don't ask for it, I know you didn't ask for it, Esther, but here it is. You may not have been brought to this point in your life for the sake of accumulating an exquisite wardrobe and precious gems and exotic fragrances. Esther, you have not been brought to this point in your life to become the most desirable and attractive woman in the kingdom. That's a shadow mission, Esther. Acquire an expensive wardrobe and exquisite perfumes. That's a shadow mission, Esther. You've been brought to this point for the reason that the king thinks you have, not for the reason that the king thinks you have. You've been brought to this point in your life to be a part of what God is doing on this earth, to work for justice and to spare people from great suffering. That's your true mission, Esther. Don't step away from it. And let me kind of reiterate to the ladies in this congregation and to the ladies that are online, because we have many accomplished women in our congregation. We have many accomplished people that watch online. Ladies, whether you're a doctor or a teacher or an administrator or a stay-at-home mom or a prosecutor, whatever you have accomplished, it is not about you. Men, the same thing goes for you. This life is not about you. You are to do things for the glory of God. The same holds true for all of us. And if all you do is work, 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 you can lose your kids because you're not doing your mission. And maybe kids aren't your mission. Maybe you're a single woman, and if that's God's calling in your life, that's fine. But whatever you do, single or married or widowed, do for the glory of God. Same for the men. Don't be distracted by the shadow mission. And so what Mordecai does is he helps Esther discern God's activity and God's calling on her life, and he issues a very strong challenge. If you say no here, Esther, if you miss this, as frightening as it is, you miss the reason why you were put on this planet. Who knows, but you've come to your position at this moment. This is your moment. This is your gold medal moment. This is it. And so Esther gets it, and I pray that in this church every one of us has a Mordecai that'll keep us on mission. I pray this church is a Mordecai church so we can keep people on mission. And Esther gets it. And she tells Mordecai that she wants to have 3 days to withdraw with her closest friends to fast and pray. And she asks them to gather together all the Jewish people in Susa to fast and pray for 3 days for her, because she will not try to achieve this mission based on her own beauty or cleverness and influence. As great as they are, her only hope is God. And so she says to Mordecai, "Give me 3 days, so I will go in unto the king, which is not according to the law." And so she responds with the words that are as magnificent as they are courageous. "If I perish, I perish." What a woman. "I'm going to go to the king, even though it's against the law, and if I die, I die." And Ahasuerus, Xerxes, this goofy Animal House kind of king, he's got no idea what he signed up for when he made Esther queen. You know, years ago, true story, years ago, Mattel had to issue a recall on G.I. Joes and Barbie dolls, because the little, you know, they used to have G.I. Joes and you could pull the string on the back and it'd say something. And you had Barbie dolls the same way. And they actually transposed and switched the voice boxes of the Barbies into the G.I. Joes. And the G.I. Joe voices went into the Barbie dolls. And so when you pulled the G.I. Joe string, it would say, "Let's shop till we drop." And seriously, in a very feminine, "Let's shop till we drop." And when you pulled Barbie's string, it said, "Hit the ground hard, hard, hard." So what Ahasuerus got, he signed up for Barbie, but Ahasuerus got G.I. Joe. He didn't get what he was thinking of. And that's what's going on in this story. And I want to pause for just a moment to think about two questions. It's kind of personal stuff, but what's your shadow mission? I want to ask it again, because we all have one. If your life just goes on default mode, it's going to drift. Maybe it's about projecting an attractive image, because in our culture, 2,500 years later, it's still a big deal. It was for Esther. It's about looking good. Maybe your shadow mission is about more money, more power, more security. Maybe your shadow mission is quasi-spiritual, you know, looking really good spiritually, or feeling really self-righteous about yourself, or kind of superior to other folks. And it's a funny thing to me, and I've been through a lot of organizations that have worked on developing mission statements, you know, and I think that can be a really good thing. And so we kind of have a sense to where our calling as an organization is, or my calling as a person or as a pastor is. And I know that, and I like to go back and read mission statements. As a matter of fact, it's part of the Bureau's standards that the leadership has to read the mission statement once a year, because I think it helps sometimes to get us back on point. So what's your shadow mission? Here's another question. Is there a Mordecai in your life? Because I encourage everybody to get one. I love our church, and I love the way we kind of break out into small groups and we talk and things like that, and I think that's a very healthy church. Who's the Mordecai in your life to call you? Because sometimes the good is the enemy of the best, right? And God wants the best for us. And I want to thank the Mordecais at this church that I have. As a matter of fact, I had a lady come up to me and correct me on a kind of a statement that I've been saying in church. And she was 100% right. And my ministry will improve because of that. Knowing kids sometimes will be Mordecai kids to me. And dad, you know, that what you're doing behind the wheel, you know, what if that was a church member? Yeah, I get Mordecai moments in my kids. We all need it. Well, and so Esther, who's your Mordecai? And if you don't have one, make sure you get one. So Esther had Mordecai, and that changed everything. This beauty queen, this trophy wife, she fasts and prays for 3 days and puts on the royal robes. And you can't imagine what's going on inside of her. She goes to the king in her rooms, and she stands in the inner court, and she waits for the king in defiance of the law, life and death hanging in the balance. A very, very pivotal moment. She sees the king, in a moment, and he reaches out the golden scepter, and she's going to live, at least for the day. And then chapter 5, verse 3, the king says, what is it, Queen Esther? You know, what's your request? Even up to half the kingdom, I will give it to you. Now, it looks like she can have anything she wants to at this point, but know that this is king talk for, hey, it's great to see you. I'm in a really good mood today. And he didn't literally mean, I'm going to give you half my kingdom. Because if she had asked for that, the king's mood would have soured substantially. This is guy talk for, hey, you want to have the remote control tonight? That's what's going on. So he says, you know, what's up? I'll give it to you, even a half of my kingdom. And she can't really say at this moment, I'd like to have you revoke the unrevocable law of the Medes and the Persians and put down your chief of staff. So, question. Esther, this young lady, what's popular in this culture? Parties. We've seen that at least four times. Party, 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 party. So Esther's actually a pretty smart person. She says to the king, I'm going to throw a party. She works within the culture that she's raised. You know, that's actually kind of a good sign for us as Christians. Work within the culture that you're raised. Be in the world, but not of the world. Right? Work within the culture that you have. And that's what Esther's doing. And so it says, verses 6 and 7, what is thy petition that shall be granted to thee? What is thy request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be performed. And then answered Esther and said, my petition, my request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if I please the king to grant my position, perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said. So Esther here is showing great skill. And so now we're getting ready for the climax of the story, but not yet, because the author is going to leave us in suspense for a moment. We have a side story going on in chapter 5. Then went Haman forth that day, joyful and with glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai on the king's date, that he stood not up nor moved for him, because he was living his shadow mission. He was full of indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself, and when he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh his wife. And Haman told him of the glory of his riches, the multitude of his children, and all the things wherein the king had promoted him, and how he advanced above the princes and the servants of the king. And Haman said, moreover, yea, Mordecai the queen did let no man come in with the king into the banquet that she had prepared, but myself. And tomorrow I'm invited unto her also with the king. Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I had seen Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. See, Haman had a shadow mission, and his mission was shadow mission was called more. More wealth, more power, more applause, more success. And when you live for your shadow mission, it is never enough, because there's never satisfaction in the shadow mission. You don't get to enjoy the blessings that you have because you can't focus on it, because you're living a shadow mission. And oddly enough, that same night, the king can't sleep. So the king says, servants, read to me. And they read to him out of the book of Chronicles, of their chronicles, the annuals of the king. And guess what? The annuals of the king, just so happens that they turn to a passage in all of the annuals about a guy named Mordecai who saved Ahasuerus' life, and he had never been honored. So Haman shows up the next day. He doesn't know about the king reading this. He walks in, and the king says, Haman, look, what do I want to do for a man that I want to honor? And Haman, of course, thinks it's about him. And Haman says, put him on the royal chariot, put him on the robes around him, have him driven all around the kingdom, and let people just bow down and praise this dude. Because you know what? Haman was living a shadow mission, and it was all about him. And then King Xerxes, and here's the downfall, and it's all downfall from here. King Xerxes says, that's a really great idea. Do it for Mordecai. And now it's all downhill, and Haman is humiliated, and Esther holds a banquet, and the next night she tells the king's story, and she and the people are about to be destroyed. And this weak king says, who's going to do that? And she says, that wicked Haman. And Haman ends up being hanged on the very gallows that he built for Mordecai. So the king needs a new chief of staff, and who does he appoint? Well, Esther's there, and Esther says, Mordecai. And Mordecai is appointed. And then Esther goes back to the king, and she reminds the king of the old edict of, you know, death to the Jews still stands. And the king says to Esther, chapter 8, verse 8, write also for the Jews as it liketh you in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. So now Esther is writing legislation for the king. And the people of Israel are favored, and we're told in chapter 8, verse 17, and many of the people of the land became Jews. So through the actions of a lady that's living her true mission and not her shadow mission, not a shadow mission about wardrobes or perfumes or wealth, but a true mission of service, lives are saved, legislation's written, good men are appointed. See what happens when you surrender to God? All because one man, Mordecai, was willing to name reality to a young woman and say no to a shadow mission of safety and security and wealth, and yes, to following God to the point of giving her life. And now, and now, and now, it's your day. It's your time. You are where you are, and I don't know why. And maybe you don't either, but you have been given and you, where you are for a reason. And it may not be as dramatic as Esther, but you have a mission and you have a challenge. And the good news is, well, let me give you the bad news first. The bad news is, on your own strength, we will always give in to our shadow mission. But the good news is that Jesus understands. And let me tell you why I've been thinking about this, because Jesus faced a shadow mission himself. And I think for Jesus, his shadow mission, the shadow mission of Jesus, was to be a Messiah, to wear a crown without the suffering and without the cross. Because time and time again, the temptation came to Jesus from many directions to choose a less costly way of fulfilling his calling than the way of suffering and death that he was ordained to do. But Jesus resisted his shadow calling. And at the very beginning in the desert, some of you know this story, Satan comes to him and says, hey, you can be Messiah on mission without hunger. We could turn these stones to bread. You could be a Messiah on mission without pain. Throw yourself down and the angels will bear you up. You could be a Messiah on a mission without opposition. You know, bow before me and all the kingdoms of the earth are going to bow before you. And Jesus says, no, 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 that's not my mission. That's a shadow mission. And then later on, when he tells the disciples that he's going to have to suffer and die, Peter pulls him aside and says, don't say that. Don't talk that way. That doesn't have to happen. You don't have to suffer. You don't have to die. And that's why Jesus rebukes Peter so sharply and says, get behind me, Satan. Because that kind of talk is a shadow talk. It's a shadow mission. That's where that comes from. And Jesus wrestles with this shadow mission all the way to the Garden of Gethsemane. And then in Matthew chapter 26, verse 39, he prays, oh, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. In other words, I'd rather not suffer, but if that's your calling on my life, I'll suffer. You know, it's kind of ironic to me. There's a book and a movie out there called Da Vinci Code. And the Da Vinci Code actually is a movie about Jesus giving in to his shadow calling, where he actually is raised and has a family and lives an ordinary life. And what that's showing is it's, in fact, Jesus giving in to his biggest temptation, to give in to the shadow mission, to be a Messiah without suffering, without the cross, without embracing agony in human form. It's just heresy. And now, your life and mine, if I could, we're part of a bigger mission and a much bigger story, and that's what's going on behind the scenes in the book of Esther. Esther is the only book in the Bible that never mentions the word God, and I think that's for a reason. I think it's because, as is often the case in our life, he seems to be off stage. But even though you can't see him, he is the main character in the story. And the writer keeps bringing this up again and again and again. There is a law that is unalterable, but it's not the law of the Medes and the Persians. Because how is it that of all the women in the empire, a Jewish girl named Esther becomes a queen? That of all the people in the empire, Mordecai is the one that saved him from the assassination? that of all the nights the king should insomnia, the very night that Haman built the gallows for Mordecai's night, and that of all the stories that one read to the king, it was the one about Mordecai saving his life. And that Haman, the scheming murderer, becomes a victim of his own scheme. That Mordecai, his intended victim, becomes his replacement. How did the king's ring given to Haman end up on Mordecai's finger? How did the noose intended for Mordecai's neck hang Haman's neck? And how is it that people who marked the Jews for destruction became Jews themselves, and the ones that marked them for destruction were destroyed themselves? And the writer wants us to understand that even in exile, even there, there's no Jerusalem, no temple, no Sanhedrin, in unseen, unknown, unnamed, unlikely ways, in mangers, on crosses, in carpools, in cubicles, God is present and God is at work. And we can do that and be part of it when we live our true mission.